You are listening to The Dystopian Republic, and I, Raul Guerrero, am your host. We begin today's story on the evening of December 23rd, 2008. Bells jingled out of an adorable boombox that had an audio player connected to it, bringing cozy music to Swindon's ears. Sucking on a candy cane, she was packing her bags for the big trip, Catherine revealed to her, Hull, Jilson, and Ray earlier in the month. Swindon couldn't be more eager to make the forests of Las Grandes Cascadas into her own personal wonderland. In the living room, Catherine ripped up the Christmas card her ex-husband wrote and sent to her daughter, calling it a pathetic and disgusting attempt to re-enter her girl's life. She watched TV and was uncomfortably irate to see Poole Garibay announce the penultimate day of Navigator's Happy Holiday Sale. Catherine gave him a glaring middle finger that wanted to take a gasoline tank and shove it up his rectum and douse his intestines with fuel. Poole stood on the rooftop heliport atop Navigator's Delgadopolis headquarters, looking down at downtown with a cold frown and crossed arms. He wasn't expecting Swindon to get his card, but tried sending it to her anyway for the thrill of getting under Catherine's skin yet again. Poole didn't care if his attempt to have contact with his daughter risked the judge finding him in contempt of court. He knew that Navigator will always have his back and welcome him with open arms the second he's released from jail. His new girlfriend, Spade Santos, sensually sauntered to his side, held his right shoulder, and told him that it's time to go, making him smile and so proud of himself for being a lucky man. During the limo ride, Poole caressed his girl's silky brunette hair as she napped on his lap and grinned at the love he was giving her. His mind told Catherine that while Swindon and their lowly hood may be on her side, he has the millions, elite status, endless connections, and most important of all, the girl of his dreams in his corner. Poole had a hard time not looking at Spade as her 19-year-old youth made her a black diamond he was glad to have with him. He especially loved the fact that she was formerly an orphan from Xochitl City, Xochitlia's capital and largest city. While Poole was rich and Spade lived paycheck to paycheck, their tendency to go and get what they wanted at any cost enamored them to one another. Unfortunately for Catherine, the fenced cabin she, Swindon, Hull, Jilson and Ray planned to have their Christmas at was the one Bliss and Drina Martin Rocio called home. On the night of November 26th, it was lit up by gold candles covered in fake snow and had ornamented trees dispersed everywhere. An in-ground fire pit safely shot flames high at its center, warming up a night where wind chills were in the upper 20s. Marty finished knitting the pair of gloves she made with the fur pelts of the rabbits Rocio was cooking and turning over the flames. Bliss let her mind get lost in a sizable music box with enough tunes to form an album dedicated to each of Christmas's 12 days. Andrina came back with a bag now full of the peppergrass, watercress, and bugleweed she picked from a tiny herb farm that appears to have been idle for decades. She assumed that the person who lived there was a recluse who made an adequate living off her farming. Andrina could tell that whoever owned the farm was antisocial to the core because of all the towering, thick, barbed wire she had to chainsaw through to access the herbs. Since she entered from the back, she never saw the big signs that told people not to enter as the property was condemned for a skull and crossbone danger. Wood and all, Andrina ran the herbs through an herb mill, garnishing the rabbits Rocio finished cooking at about the same time. Neither they, Bliss nor Marti, ate that night with any concern of where the garnish had been, thinking only about filling their bellies and the Christmas party they were intent on having the next night. Rocio had no problem going to sleep, but it took an hour of looking at the ceiling and all around for Andrina to finally fall asleep. Marti's sleep appeared uneasy and stiff, soaking her in a sweat and ruining her night with a truly horrible nightmare. When the sky's slow step into the daytime dimly lit up the cabin, Bliss woke up, happily crying, thanking the increasing light for ending a pain so severe that it had her begging to be killed. Rocio squeezed her skull, clenched her teeth, and had her head down, panting in scaredy agony as if her brain was going to rupture. Yaz, woos, and whistles from chauvinist pigs laughed at her ear-bleeding wails, cheering more proudly the louder her wailing got. Naked in the fetal position, Marti shivered like she was in hell, awaiting her turn to burn in the magma pool, her clothes scattered on her bed and near it. Andrina resolutely stood over and grimaced at the fire pit as embers burned, glowed, and flamed ever so slightly. Marti got back enough of her composure to sit on her lower legs, take the breaths needed to talk again, and put her clothes back on without an ashamed thought. Bliss watched it all happened with a heart heavier than a truck and smile weaker than a straw strand, her brain playing the moment Mia, Sonia, and Nova beat and told her to kill herself. The daylight revealed every speck of the property's wondrous white, piney green, toasty red, cozy yellow, and saintly brown. This ignored what was really happening to Bliss, Andrina, Marti, and Rocio, but that change would make itself known one stage at a time. Catherine didn't wait for the sun to rise on December 24th to begin her trip with Swindon, Hull, Gilson, and Ray in hopes of beating the holiday traffic. Her route went eastbound on the Delbrue Highway, then up the North Shore Highway, spending 9 hours in traffic that was often residentially slow to the frustration of her and her teenaged passengers. Once the trip turned to the northeast, Catherine was glad she hit the road at 3:30 in the morning, as that made arriving before dark much less of a long shot. Her leisurely drive through Las Grandes Cascadas' winding roads pulled over behind a Laramie sports sedan with its doors open and loud, rumbling engine still running. Gilson found that odd. Ray wondered why anyone would abandon a car that awesome, and Swindon insisted on staying seated and buckled. Hull told Catherine to be careful as he followed her out into the vehicle, sensing that something seemed off. Gilson stayed with Swindon to assure her that everything was going to be okay as Ray ran for the sedan and started taking pictures of it with her smartphone. Catherine checked the car's interior and opened its trunk to find no one inside, but could feel and smell that it had been recently occupied. Hull was looking for identification in the center console and glove box, but heard feet hiking his way. He told Catherine and Ray to cease what they're doing as the sedan's owners were coming, pushing them to rush back into their GS minivan and speed off without being seen. Relief warmed up the interior's air with a jolliness that made the drive to a narrow but well-fortified metal gate on the side of the road plain sailing. Unlike the car left running, nothing about where Catherine and the teens were was out of place or concerning. Hull dialed the number combination that unlocked the gate. Swindon drove the minivan past it. Gilson relocked it and Ray parked the vehicle at the lone parking space inside. That was when Catherine and the teens saw the hidden path they know will lead to the cabin that'll make the best Christmas ever a reality. They spent the first quarter mile of their hike singing and dancing their steps to Christmas carols to break the holiday ice. Their walk in the spirit gradually paused at a smell reminiscent of fecal matter, making Swindon suspect that bears may be afoot. Catherine readied her two spray deterrents and said that no damn supersized teddy's gonna make her or the teens into chow. She aimed the cans all around like guns in anticipation of at least one bear, making the mistake of calling her bluff only to smell feces and hear flies. Catherine told the teens to hold their noses and promised that the vile scents will subside once they're far enough away from the bear poop, but the stench would get worse the closer they got to the cabin and made Swindon wonder if the smell was really from fecal matter, alarming her, her mother, Hull, Gilson, and Ray. Suspecting that intruders were on her private property, Catherine put away her deterrents and took out a loaded pistol. That was when Swindon let out the most horrible shriek her mother's ever heard, leading them and the others to a young lady who's had her throat slit. The woman's head was peeking out of a dense bush that hit the rest of her otherwise untouched body. While the teens were utterly petrified, Catherine grieved like she knew her, confirming this with one skin-whitening look of her former driver's license. Then, Hull shrieked with an identical horror at a teenage couple who was tied up and had their skullcaps blasted away execution style. Right then and there, Ray let out a yell and screamed that the whole family's been effing burned, repeating that scream as many times as her larynx and lungs would allow. Gilson squealed, fell back, and had her hands over her mouth, panting in hysterical disbelief at the severed limbs piled up like firewood. Lamenting with rage, Catherine screamed for the teens to get within her reach and handed them the other pistols she packed in her bag. She was aware that by arming Swindon and her friends, she'd make them fair game as far as the murderers were concerned. Catherine knew that the teens were dead meat had she not given them her other guns, but believed that by doing so, they'd have a chance to survive. The five ventured onward as one, not to celebrate, but to defend their lives against the monsters who've occupied their cabin. They were close enough to the path's end to finish walking down its path and too far into their hike to turn back. Catherine knew of a fortified place where she and the teens can safely take refuge in, but it's in an exposed space mere feet from the fence circling the cabin, meaning that completing the walk was a must. The five waited for traces of nature's ambience to return, removed their shoes, belts, and anything that can make noise. With thick socks on, jogging until the fence was in sight was easy to keep quiet, but not screaming and crying was easier said than done, thanks to human and animal blood coating and malodoring the forest by the splatter and smear. Catherine and the teens knew that there were lots of criminals on the run, but found the barbarity all around to be too ugly even for the most hardened soul. Their refuge was a cellar made of metal, and to look like a little hill grown from ivy and soil slabbing over it like artificial grass. But more importantly, it had a call box where police, fire, and medical could be contacted with one press of a blue, red, or white button. Knowing what must be done, Catherine and the teens darted for the cellar as their hearts pounded in parallel to that sprint's every step. Their fear-filled dart had them asking God to let them make it if he really existed, and not only got inside the cellar unharmed, they did so without a murderer in sight. But alas, that feeling of a prayer being answered disappeared when the five found the call box ripped out and smashed apart. Neither Catherine nor the teens had time to be devastated by that discovery because of the scurrying they heard come from outside. Ray quickly and quietly locked the cellar door, then she and the others nervously aimed their guns at it, anticipating a hell of a fight with one or more devils incarnate. In silence, the five heard the forest's volume decrease the closer the scurrying got, elevating their already sky-high fear even more. But 10 minutes later, the scurries dissipated, allowing the cellar's indoor aura to return and for the wild's instruments to resume playing. Catherine wasn't sure if the scurrying was human or animal in nature, but did ready herself to switch from shooting guns to spraying deterrent on impulse. Another hour of natural ambience and nothing else let her and the teens muster up the courage to contemplate attempting an escape. The fives shared fear of being caught by the murderers trembled their every tiptoe up the cellar stairs and made keeping the noise to a minimum difficult. Every second it took to unlock and open the door had them fearing that the most subdued creak, shallowest rumble, or softest slam could alert the murderers. When the five emerged from the cellar and beheld nature's tunes, breathing got easier and running for help became possible. The teens knew as much as Catherine did that they had to get every cop in the province to their location immediately, otherwise the body count will grow. Seeing dusk set in, their sprint for it lasted 3 stomps, jolting their falls down at the blast of 3 harsh diodes. Catherine's heart sank when Andrina ordered her and the teens not to move, asking if her eyes were deceiving her as Marti and Rocio emerged from the dark. The holy effing S, Ray screamed out, couldn't properly stress how stunned she was to have 3 of Bromelia's more notorious murderers in her presence. Jilson never forgot how Bliss, Andrina, Marti and Rocio blew the Hada Mio compound and many on or in it to kingdom come. Hull's shock mixed with an ire at how cruelly kids like Mia, Sonia, and Nova were killed, and how the wanted girls maimed their own flesh and blood. Catherine panted a stare so deadly it reminded Andrina, Marti, and Rocio of how ghoulish Edmundo Jr. looked that one time his darker side came out. She called the wanted girls wretched C-words and asked how they got their hands on her assault rifles, to the teens' shocked disgust. With a 4th lethal diode, Bliss giggled her walk into view, recommending that Catherine watch her language if she wished to still have one. Her giggle froze when she laid eyes on Swindon as frost overcame and stiffened her nerve fibers like tungsten-reinforced mold. Hull, Gilson, and Ray shuddered at the idea that their friend and Bliss knew each other and forbade heaven if those two were ever pals. Too frightened to say her ex-pen pal's name, Swindon focused on pointing her gun out, despite her grip being weak and shaky. Bliss told her that for her, menacing was pointless because they both knew no shot will ever be fired, as the guilt it'll cause will be fatal. Swindon said that she was never a pal of hers with a voice that could crack at the slightest press in of an index finger and thumb. That's when Ray noticed that the clothes the wanted girls had on were in conditions too good for people who've been on the run for nearly a month. Andrina wore a dark jade tweed blazer, shadowy gray denims, and black canvases that hardly touched her knees. Marty's clothes were a black, skinny, dressy button-down, chinos faded to the point of losing their darkness, and shoes reinforced for construction work. Rocio wore a burnt orange tweed that was more jacket than shirt, and navy blue cargoes with pockets from the waist down to just above her urban sneakers. Bliss's clothes were a taupe mocking neck, garnet red scarf, artificially dyed rabbit fur gloves, clean low-rise jeans, and ankle boots. Andrina congratulated Ray for noticing the clothes she and her dear sisters wore, saying that each garment had a story behind them. Catherine yelled that she and the teens didn't want to hear any of her wicked stories, annoying Rocio into scoffing at her for believing that she had a say in the matter, given their respective positions. Hull caught Marty making eyes at Bliss, and his heart lost a portion of its faith in humanity when the latter met that look with one just as passionate. Hit by envious itches, Andrina and Rocio tried to one-up those eye makes with their own, which were inferior thanks to how long they've been a pair. Hull listened to Toddy talk about each of the wanted girls individually on her radio show, and what he learned was unspeakably horrific. Acting on a hunch, Andrina shot Catherine on the right shoulder, shaking Marty and Rocio into capping her knees with lead. Swindon, Hull, Gilson, and Ray tried returning fire, but were aghast to find that their guns had no bullets in them. But this didn't stop Bliss from firing shots that narrowly missed them on purpose, messing them up with burning shards. The bullets that came out of the rifles were of such a high caliber and large size that the fragments themselves could be lethal. And since Catherine had that firepower go through her shoulder and knees, she was a real mess, but alive and conscious thanks to the body armor she wore under her sweater. The real pain for her was that in addition to her gun being unreachable, Bliss had shot it apart in the midst of her shooting. Fearing their lives, Swindon, Hull, Gilson, and Ray announced their surrender, pleasing Andrina into declaring that the tour was a go. The teens were bleeding a lot too, but didn't have the severe injuries that Catherine did, hoping that by giving up, their survival would be assured. Respectively, Bliss, Andrina, Marty, and Rocio grabbed and had Swindon, Hull, Ray, and Gilson at gunpoint, directing them to the area in front of the cabin. Catherine looked up at the post-dusk sky as her senses started fading away, then saw a thrown-away bowl of hardly-eaten rabbit overcooked in herbs. The unsatisfactory dish had a mint smell so overpowering that she could smell it from her vantage point 4 meters away, making her wonder why that scent wasn't noticeable earlier. A minute whiff that stench made Catherine ask herself why it was familiar, encouraging her to use her left arm to crawl over to that bowl. Once within reach of the dish, the smell assaulted her sinuses and throat as if she was allergic to its source. Catherine covered her mouth and nose with her good arm, rolling over as if a flame had blasted her face. As great as the physical pain was, the panic she went into was more intense, spelling out to her exactly what happened to the wanted girls. Catherine realized that she was dealing with a potion so evil that few have survived it, and even fewer have been freed of its grip. Presented by the wanted girls to their Christmas wonderland, the teens saw blood, flesh, organs, bones, limbs, heads, and bodies hung on trees like ornaments. Some corpses were dismembered while others remained whole, but they were all people who did something to provoke the deepest, darkest corners that the teal potion had unbridled. Swindon, Hull, Chilson, and Ray's spirits dampened to numbing lows they've never fallen to, seeing death, decay, and despair everywhere. It was as though a human slaughterhouse had been made out of Santa's North Pole, taking them back to the countless graphic tales they read, watched, and listened to in Vermilion history class. Andrina asked the teens if they liked, smirked when not one of them answered, and said that their opinions were as undesirable as urine and excrement. She said the arrogant, spoiled lady with the slit throat was a suspect in the homicides of two elderly janitors in Alexisville looking to make it six she's murdered, but ended up dying her victims' deaths. Andrina added that the overprivileged B-word's mistakes were giving into her thirst for blood, seeking to increase her body count, joining a group whose leader she's never met, seen, or heard the voice of, and arrogantly picking a fight with her and her dear sisters. Little did Marti know that the lady was merely the first of many creatures she and her friends would have to deal with. Not long after that woman's demise, a young couple stumbled onto the cabin, intending to loot it and spend hours in their heaviest plunders ever. Their desire to make good on that intention was such that they were ready to murder and maim, pursuing it like they did the last three times, two of which involved children. In Bromelia, plunder also meant falling into a consciousness made stupid by alcohol or to rest on the colorful clouds by hallucinogens. That word and others had definitions only Bromelians utilized for different means, some benevolent and others malevolent. Marti's point was that the couple got caught in the act, tried to kill her and her sisters, and paid the ultimate price for doing so, a payment her soul proudly pinned on its blazer. Rocio overheard a grown family furiously fall out over confessions that ached even her heart as they concerned her time under Manola's so-called care years ago. She recalled that clan being four particularly violent and prolific instruments, forgetting their names, but knew that their lives were spent seeking and destroying. Rocio believed that burning them to death would accustom them to the incinerations Satan prepared just for them. Bliss described the severed limbs as spoils that belonged to the same pawns that worked for Rigoberto and Bacarne. She called the people previously mentioned and their cronies instruments that can only create the tunes of death, agony, and hopelessness. Bliss added that Mia, Sonia, and Nova would have joined the orchestra people like Dean Jr. conducted had she and her sisters not given them what they effing deserved. Catherine's exceptional hearing allowed her to hear every word said, aching her heart as if an infection had inflamed it to an enlarged orb. Ray couldn't unlook the photos police took of Mia, Sonia, and Nova dead. Uncensored images that illegally trended on Prysip. Poole and Spade had roasted chicken, cherry pie, steamed broccoli, fruit salad, spiked eggnog, sliced pumpernickel bread for their Christmas dinner. She nicely excused herself to the bathroom to call one of the instruments she summoned to Las Grandes Cascadas. Waiting for her call to be picked up, Spade was glad that Poole knew nothing about her other life, believing that she'd be effed if he did. She found it odd and a tad worrying that no one answered, making her contact her master and ask her if that band arrived. Spade quietly yelled her ask to know what the superior meant when she said that the entourage never reported for duty via phone call like they were supposed to. That master told Spade to relax and that she's got a squad en route to the reporting point to confront them for their failure to report. She assured her that everything will be under control again soon, hanging up as an old lady who turned out to be none other than Vance Jr.'s mother, Sophia, who had said son visiting her for Christmas. Provincial police zeroed in on the gate that led to the cabin, blew it open with a spherical explosive that could stick onto metal, and stormed in, ready to shoot. In the air, a helicopter approached the yellow dot on its radar, as many green ones did the same, but then saw red-dotted masses close in from the opposite direction. Its pilot notified officers that numerous hostiles were ahead, just in time for them to be the first to open fire. That gun battle startled Bliss, Andrina, Marti, and Rocio, Esless, yelling at them that they can't be caught or they won't live to be formally charged. They sprayed the ground near Swindon Hull, Ray and Jilson's feet, wounding them to a degree that appeared fatal. Bliss apologized for having to hurt them so badly, but was confident that she, her sisters, and they will meet again either in this life or after it. She, Andrina, Marti, and Rocio timidly said their last goodbyes and ran northward between the cabin's path and the way they accessed it, hearing the battle get a little closer. They inwardly and repeatedly told themselves that they'll survive, thrive, and not suffer or die, now or never, letting that fuel their running. No matter how far those four got from the cabin, the battle never grew distant, almost like it was following them. Endless repeats of trees and brush had them staggering and weaving in disorientated exhaustion, gaining negligible distance from the carnage to their increasing discomposure. Their efforts to sprint like race cars slowed to walking stomps as fatigue set in, mocking them for thinking that they had gotten away with their crimes. They sincerely believed that the cabin was their key to a new life, one independent of society and its people. Their hope running on fumes, the four stumbled upon a tree with an overgrowth, thinness, and hollowness like the one Chase, Rian, and Nicole rested in peace in. Once inside, Bliss, Andrina, Marti, and Rocio fell onto its flat dirt floor as if they had dropped dead from mortal bullet wounds. The relief they felt from getting the battle outside their hearing ranges was much weaker than their dejection over losing the cabin. Those four whimpered themselves to sleep without caring about whether they'll wake up under arrest, dying from sadness, or in the afterlife. Cold breaths and below-freezing air opened Bliss, Rocio, Marti, and Andrina's eyes to a natural stillness only they inhabited. That made them feel a lot better and stripped their fear of stepping out of its heat, elating their steps onto a Christmas morning where snow showers were scattered. The flurries danced and twirled to a hymn that sought to have them smile at something that wasn't retaliatory, violent, or hateful for the first time in a while. Its climax was the girls hugging with cheerful grins and joyous eyes, making them look like they were in a utopian trance. When the flurries eased, those four faintly heard cars pass by at freeway speeds, raising their chances of finding long-term refuge from near zero to slim. They've heard about Las Grandes Cascadas' less populated areas being hotbeds for squatters, thanking its governor for letting them squat and leaving landlords not knowing what to do. The girls tasked themselves with finding an apartment to occupy and a sympathizer who can kill them on paper and rebirth them as different people. After a mile and a half of running toward the passing cars, they bolted onto the side of a highway road where a motel turned apartment row was across from where they stood. Those four hid behind trees to make sure no drivers and passengers see them and promptly notify police, peeking out just enough to see what's ahead and not an inch more. The forest tucked in the apartment, its parking lot, the surrounding grass and road it was beside, relying on the disorientingly endless woodland to hide itself. Sophia looked ready for a Christmas party, and so did her apartment, but her face was long due to the squad she summoned being killed or arrested. Her headache and the tear that broke out of her right eye underscored how greatly upset she was that the crew she ordered to go to the reporting point was revoltingly wiped out. Spade relegated the failures to the back of her mind by opening presents with Poole, as his suspicion of her wasn't at zero anymore. He started believing that something was up with her and that she's taken part in an endeavor she knew he'd never approve of, planning to call up a private investigator to get to the bottom of her increased desire for privacy. Poole saw Spade as someone who rarely demanded privacy and didn't request it several times a week, let alone every day. When she yelled the way she did in the bathroom, that alarmed him because he's heard that exact yell before, and what followed it wasn't pretty to say the least, vowing not to let those subsequent events repeat afresh. Sophia cheered herself up with an encore presentation of Bromelia's Supper 2008, a feast of fun, music, presents, nativity, tricks, and food. It ended with Romulo and Blackburn Sr. announcing that they've formed a coalition government to bring the election stalemate to an end that'll bring liberals and conservatives together, laughing like best friends. Their bipartisan union wasn't the first one that Bromelia had, and those who were alive in the early 1960s weren't eager for it to be sworn in. Prysip's rage erupted like a volcano at this announcement, and people like Livingston Sr. and Roosevelt Sr. believed that no good will come of this coalition, buckling their psyches for a ride like few others. Although authorities won the battle deftly, the task of cleaning the forest of the dead made them feel like they've lost. The fact that their Christmas was spent killing others and watching their comrades die left them feeling dead inside. Despite her injuries being regarded as critical, Catherine never lost consciousness, and incredibly, Hull, Gilson, Ray, and Swindon were found in sickening states, but breathing on their own. Two independent journalists caught Romulo having Blackburn step into the presidential limo first in a shocking act of humility. The security all around didn't stop them from catching this on Zoom's in-film, an excellent addition to a film they've been working on. Bliss, Andrina, Marti, and Rocio waited for the dense fog to fully set in so that their run across the street won't result in them being spotted. They then heard a Laramie V10 crew cab do 70, slam its brakes, screech its turn onto the Rose parking lot, pull up in front of the centermost room door, rev twice, and switch off. The girls were shaken up by the erratic driving, but it failed to deter them from seeing who that driver was. And when he stepped out, he revealed himself as a man Bliss knew very effing well and was shocked when Andrina, Martín and Rocío looked at him as if they also had a history with him. That driver was Vance himself, and he firmly knocked on the door and hugged Sophia right after she answered, frothing the girl's mouth rabidly. While Bliss's issues with him were many and intense, they paled in comparison to how odious and sadistic he was to Andrina, Martín and Rocío. And as fate would have it, the boil over that just occurred would be an opener for another that'll do more than overflow. And that was the boil over. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the story I just gave. Share this show with everyone you know. Make sure they share it with everyone they know. Check out my website at www.rss.com/podcasts/The Dystopian Republic. Send me your respectful questions and constructive feedback at RaulGuerreroJr95@gmail.com. On that note, I'm Raul Guerrero, and come again for another gripping, thoughtful, and sinister episode of The Dystopian Republic.